So Purim's coming up, and this is not directly Purim-related, but it's connected to Purim in the sense that we know Chazal teaches that Purim was kind of like a re-Kabbalas HaTorah, re-acceptance of the Torah. And Purim, without getting into exactly where you see this too much, but Purim has a lot of themes of the connection between Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaal Peh, right? Between the written Torah and the oral Torah. And as well as this last week's Parsha has a lot of, Parsha Mishpatim is the Parsha which introduces us to civil laws in the Torah. And that, of course, brings into a whole huge amount of Torah Shebaal Peh that's brought into the picture. So I thought we'd explore a little bit the relationship between Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaal Peh, and specifically with regards to punishments in the Torah. Punishments in the Torah, I think it's a fascinating area to explore, and you'll see what I mean as we go. So let's just dive right in. This past week's Parsha, and throughout the Torah, there are a lot of situations of very harsh punishments. The Torah is a very, very harsh punishments. The capital penalty is theoretically, as we'll see, only theoretically, but theoretically employed to a nice amount of crimes. It's not just like here and there random. It's a pretty decent amount of crimes are punishable by death. Lashes are administered for basically any standard prohibition in the Torah. And these are some pretty harsh penalties. What's fascinating about it is that when Torah Shebaal Peh comes into the picture, when the oral law comes into the picture, the rabbinic interpretation or tradition of the Torah, the penalties that you would think from reading the Torah, would be administered in a pretty consistent way, assuming people were violating, hopefully not, but assuming that was happening, you would think these penalties would be administered in a consistent way. The Torah Shebaal Peh comes in and moderates, not only moderates, almost precludes the possibility of ever doing it. And you'll see what I mean in a second. Look in source number one. The Gemara teaches us about a halacha called hasra'a. Amar Ula. Ula said, Minayin lahasra'a min hatorah. How do we know that you have to warn the person in order for them to be able to be eligible, funny word to use, but to be eligible for the penalty? How do we know that in the Torah? Shinne Amar, as it says in the Pasuk, V'ish asher yikach et achoto bat aviv o bat imo. If a person sleeps with their sister, V'ra'a et ervata, and he sees her nakedness. So the question the Gemara says is, Atu b'ri'iya talya milta. Does it matter that he saw her? What is it? Why is the Pasuk focusing on emphasizing the fact that he saw her? It's about what they did together, not about seeing. So says the Gemara, it doesn't mean, in this context, it doesn't mean that it was about seeing. It's coming to teach us something else. Ela adshir uhu ta'amo shel davar. That it's coming to hint to us a different halacha, which is that the person's only liable to receive the punishment if he was shown with full vision and clarity what the crime he was about to do was. Meaning, if he was warned, if he was told, you are about to violate a crime, are you sure you want to be doing this, right? And only if he had that type of clarity before committing the crime, then he's able to be punished. But if not, then he wouldn't be punished. That's called hasra'a or hatra'a. Okay? And the Gemara goes on to bring other sources for this. And there are a number of other halachot that relate to this. The Rambam, will, instead of going through each Gemara independently, we'll just look at the Rambam in source number two. The Rambam kind of summarizes them and brings them all together to kind of give us the final stamp of when can you actually administer these punishments and when can you not. So the Rambam, and you'll see what I mean in a second, why I'm saying that the Torah Shebaal Peh basically stops us from almost ever giving a death penalty. And even lashes would theoretically, we'll talk about this in a second, but would become a lot less common. So says the Rambam, Echad Talmud Chacham, the Echad Am Haaretz. Whether or not the person is a scholar or they're just a regular person, Tzarech Hasra'a Shalom Nisna Hasra'a El Lahavchan Men Shogig Lemezid Shema Shogig Haya. We need to give the person Hasra'a. You know, we need to warn them in order for them to be liable to the punishment. Why? Because we need to know for sure that they were intentional in their action. Maybe there was shogig. Shogig means that it was accidental. We need to know for sure that it was intentional in order to give them the punishment. And if we don't give them the warning ahead of time, then we might think that perhaps they were actually just, it was accidental. The Ketzon Masrin Bo, how do we give them this warning? Omrin lo prosh. We tell them, abstain, right? Go away from what you're about to do. O al taso, or stop doing what you're about to do. Shezu aveira, because this is an aveira. He v'chayev ata aleha misas based in omalkos, and you have to tell them, stop what you're doing. It's an avera. You're going to be liable for this, either death penalty or lashes. Impiresh pater. So if the person desists, so of course they're exempt. V'chinim shasak. Ohirchin barosho. So now here is what is pretty wild about this, that if the person is silent and then goes ahead with the avera, they heard the warning, they didn't acknowledge it, they just went ahead with the avera, or hirchin barosho, they even kind of nod their head, but they don't verbalize any acceptance of the warning, pater. They don't get the punishment. This doesn't mean morally that it's not reprehensible and that bidei shamayim in God's court that the person is responsible, but in our courts, in our human legal system, the person, as long as they don't, we'll see in a second, verbalize the acceptance of the warning, they are not going to be getting this punishment. Vafilu amar yodea ani, even if they say yodea ani, they say I know, still pater. Ad until sheyatir atzma lemisa. They have to actually kind of accept the misa, accept the punishment of death upon themselves. The yomar, and they have to say, al menas ken ani oseh, that I'm doing this despite the warning you just gave me. I know you just told me that I'm going to be punished by death for this crime, and I'm doing it anyways. They have to say that in order to be able to get the punishment. The achar kachi harg, and then they kill the person, so then they can get killed. V'tzar shiavor v'yaseh techef lahasra b'soch chedei dibur, and it has to be that they do the crime within a couple of seconds of having accepted this warning. Aval achar chedei dibur, but if they waited this certain amount of time, that's called toch chedei dibur, tzar hasra achar, they need to get a new warning. So it's basically impossible, because think about it, if a person knows halach, if this murderer knew anything, they would never say, right, if they're about to kill murder, when the witnesses come and say, you're going to get killed if you go ahead with this, you should stop. Why would they ever say, I know, and I'm going to do it anyways? Right, just if they want to commit the murder, so just go ahead. But why would they ever do this verbalization of accepting the punishment they're going to get? Why would they ever do that? So basically, we've just cut out any possibility of ever administering the death penalty in halacha. Basically.
How much time is the lag where you have like a limitation and it runs out and you start over?
Yeah, so that's called toch kedei dibor, within, which literally means within a time frame of speech, which refers to the being able to say the phrase Shalom Alecha Rebbe, which is just a few seconds. Right, exactly. It comes up in a number of contexts of halacha, and it's a few seconds, so it has to be pretty immediate.
Is that the exact phrase that they always
Shalom Alecha Rebbe? I think there's a discussion about Shalom Alecha Rebbe Umori or something like that.
Wow.
But
they don't act within those 3 seconds.
The guy has to have the gun out, pointed.
Right. So it's basically...
This doesn't matter if it's a biblical prohibition or a rabbinic.
Or rabbinic. So I don't know of rabbinic punish. I mean, I'm not knowledgeable enough, so I could be wrong, but I don't know of offhand of rabbinic death penalties.
So this is definitely
biblical. Yeah, yeah. So it's we basically just wiped out any possibility of death penalty. And now you'll understand that if you look at the third source, this is a very very well known Mishnah in Makos. You'll understand why this is so. The Mishnah says, "Hahoreges echad b'shavua." If a court kills someone, administers a capital punishment once in 7 years. Nikres Chovlanis. Shavua here means 7 years. I know a week, but what do you say?
Isn't there something like 70?
Yeah, you'll see in a second. You'll see in a second. So Shavua, once in 7 years, is considered a murderous based in. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says, hey, George, all right, Dennis also, yeah, pass you back. Here. So Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, Omer, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says, Echad L'Shivim, this is what you're referring to. Once in 70 years, is considered a murderous based in. Rabbi Tarfon, Rabbi Kiva Omrim, Rabbi Kiva and Rabbi Tarfon say, Ilu hayinu b'Sanhedrin lo neharag adamei olam. If we were in the Sanhedrin, we would never kill anyone ever. And based on what we just saw, the stipulations necessary to administer this punishment, you can understand why, right? Because it's going to be very difficult to actually carry out this punishment. The person has to have accepted this warning in such a limited way that it's very, very unlikely. So,
what would they typically do with murderers?
Okay, good. So there's two questions I want to address. One, just as a bracket tangential, which is that question. And the other question, which is the bigger question, let me just frame it, and then I want to get back to that. So the bigger question I want to address is, what is going on here that there's these punishments in the Torah which are basically never to be carried out. Like, what's the point in that? What does that mean? Why do we have Teresh B'Chstav, which seems so severe, and like the death penalty is almost, I don't want to say this in like a derogatory, but it's almost rampant. It's like it's very common in terms of punishment for crimes, and lashes is the basic punishment, which is also pretty severe, right? And it's pretty frequent. And then all of a sudden we have the Oral Torah coming and making it that's basically almost never going to happen. It's like it's just a strange thing going on. What is that? So that's the question I want to really delve into. Before we do that, let's just kind of take a turn off road for a second and deal with question that Steve just brought up, which is it's hard to understand how they're going to have a civil society if basically these punishments are never going to happen, right? So it's a difficult, and also just to emphasize that point further, in the Torah and in Chazal we don't really have jail. So there is a pasuk in the Torah which talks about jail, but it's not like what we think of like, you know, locking up criminals. It's not, we don't really have a jail system, just that we, you know, put people away and you know, do their time. It's not really in the Torah or in the Gemara. There are a couple of cases where it's like a situation where we want to kind of create a holdover situation, but it's not like that's a, you know, punishment that's a regular thing. So what did we do? What did they do to keep civil society?
Sent him to the cities of refuge.
Okay, so that was for specific, right? For accidental murder.
That was after
accidental.
Death.
Yeah, but if it wasn't, then you had self help.
What do you mean?
Ari Mikla wasn't for thieves, yeah. Though.
The relatives, thing though, like if you think about it, I mean, I haven't learned that sigil well enough to really speak to it, but just from a practical standpoint, the whole relatives taking care of this murderer thing, that's not really going to create a particularly civil society, right? That's just like a cycle digging our
wild,
right?
Wild west.
Right, exactly. It's like, so I'm not sure that that's exactly, so what did they do, right? So this is a big question. The Ran in source number 4, this is, and again, this is just a tangential bracket for just a couple of minutes, but the Ran has a really interesting, well-known approach. I don't know these things too well, but my brother's is a lawyer, and he told me that he went to law school in Israel, in Hebrew University. So in they're like Mishpat Ivri classes, which are kind of like, you know, just like a class, I think, my impression is like a class that's kind of in studies like, you know, Jewish, like traditional Jewish law, kind of from like
Israeli law.
Exactly.
It's like studying Talmud.
Right, exactly. Studying Talmud secularly, more kind of just gleaning like what was traditional Jewish law look like and comparing it to different things. So apparently they like to point to this Ran because it actually creates space for the idea of a government coming up with new laws for a Jewish society. So if you look in source number 4, the Ran addresses exactly your question. He writes the following. Aval, however, im lo ye'anesh ha'over ki im al zeh ha'derech, if we are not going to punish the criminal because we have all these stipulations to when we can punish them, yifsad hasidor hamidini legamri, we're going to lose all civilization. Right? We're going to lose the ability to have a functioning civil society. She is rabu shofri damim v'lo yaguru min ha'onesh, there's not many repercussions, we're going to have an increase in murderers. And he says, Duran, this is why Hashem gave us a mitzvah to appoint a king. As the Torah says, Ki tavo el ha'aretz, when you get to the land, som tasim alecha melech, you should appoint a king. Shuhu mitzvah shenitz tavinu balimno salinu melech. It's a mitzvah to appoint a king. So, of course, this is a very well-known question, which we're not going to get into now. They were punished for wanting to appoint a king. Okay, so how do you deal with the fact that it's a mitzvah, yet they were punished for it? Not for now. Kamosha baba kabbalah sarbasenu, as it says in the Gemara, v'hamelech yachol ladun shalo bahasra'a, that the king is able to carry out laws and punishments without the stipulations of these warnings that we just gave. As what in so much as what he sees fitting and necessary to create a civil functioning society. So now he says, "Bizman shiyu beYisrael Sanhedrin umel." So when the Jewish people had a Sanhedrin, a court, umelach and a king, haSanhedrin heim lishvod et ha'am b'mishpat tzedek levad. The Sanhedrin, the court, is there to enforce and to regulate what he calls mishpat tzedek. That he's referring to. It's a very, very long piece that I'm just taking out excerpts from. But he calls mishpat tzedek. He is referring to what the Torah Shebichtav says, meaning the. But the point being that which the Torah says should be the punishments and the laws, that's what the Sanhedrin enforces. meaning what we would learn in a Gemara. That's what the Sanhedrin enforces. Lo latikon inyanam, latikon inyanam biyotim izeh, not to enforce anything more than that. Im lo sheyitin hamelech lahem kocho, unless the king gives them permission. Aval kasher lo yihi hamelech biyisrael, but when there's no king, hashofet, the judges, yichlo shnei hakochot, they have both of these powers. Koach hashofet v'koach hamelech. So what he's basically explaining, to pull out of this now for a second, in a nutshell, he's basically explaining, the Torah gave us two tracks. The Torah gave us the track of the system of laws and punishments that the Torah itself teaches us, and that is the track of the Sanhedrin, of the court, that they're supposed to enforce, and that's going to have gaps and holes because of all these stipulations that we just saw. So it's not going to necessarily be able to enforce and to keep a functioning society, a moral society. But then we were given a second track of the king, who's specifically appointed to fill in those gaps and to do what the king sees necessary to make sure that society is functioning civilly. So that is, so that they come together. Now, it's an interesting thing, and this is, you know, not so much our topic, and, well, actually, this kind of does connect to the topic. When
so
when
during those periods, the period of Shoftim and Lachim didn't work out so well.
Right? Yeah, so that's a good point. Right.
I mean,
right.
Because we're dealing, I guess, with human beings, and
right.
We get corrupted.
Right.
So what do we do?
It's a good question. beyond me.
Not for this lecture.
So the question is, you know, which really is basically the same question that I mentioned before we went off on this tangent, is, so what's the point of having these laws that the Sanhedrin are enforcing if they're never actually enforcing it, right? We have these two different tracks. We have the Sanhedrin track, which is the what he calls Mishpat Tzedek, that's the Torah's laws, and then we have the Melech, which is basically filling in the gaps by doing what the Melech sees as being fit to create this good society. So what's the point in the Sanhedrin track if it's not going to be practical, if it's not going to be actualized? What's the point in all the Torah's punishments, in a nutshell? What's the point in all the Torah's punishments if they're not actually going to be for real? What's the point in that?
Deterrent.
Deterrent. Okay, good. So what do you mean?
To deter people from, if they know there's a punishment. But again, if you never enforce it.
Exactly. So that's what I was just going to say. So good. So it's a deterrent. That's, I think, the natural response. But the problem is, once you know it's not going to be enforced, is that really a deterrent?
Now, in certain crimes, people, even they know that there's a punishment, they still do it.
Right. True.
So
okay.
Right.
So kal v'chomer. Yeah. Yeah. For sure. So what is it? So what's the point in it?
Maybe it's like the sacrifices there, but for the grace of God, go I.
Meaning?
Well, you're sacrificing an animal because you blew it.
Mm-hmm.
I was taught that one way to think of it is it could have been you.
Mm-hmm.
But you're allowed to give an animal instead. So at least you're giving thought to, wow, this is really serious what I did.
Okay, good. So that's what I wanted to get at. So bringing the two answers together. So I think it's a simple suggestion that it's not a deterrent in the practical sense of, I think this punishment's going to come to me, so I'm going to stop what I'm doing. But it sends a message. What the law is stated as sends a message. The Torah's message, by having such severe punishments to our actions, is teaching us and telling us that our actions matter. It's telling us that what you do really is significant. That these are severe things. These things are significant things. These are the world stands on these actions, on these choices that you make. And the Torah is communicating that to us by assigning very strict and severe repercussions to these different actions, to these different things that people do. It's communicating to us that these things really matter. Yet, the Torah at the same time wants to communicate another message. And that's the message of understanding human error. And understanding and making space for the fact that people mess up. And people make mistakes, and there's something called tshuva. And tshuva being an essential aspect of Judaism and of Torah. That there's something called tshuva, that people can change, people can rectify, people can grow, people can move in a new direction. So the Torah, I think, brilliantly communicates that dual message of what I've titled here principles and idealism, an understanding of how severe, how important our actions are, and at the same time the message of understanding a compassion for humanity, understanding that people are frail, people are we're finite beings, and we are fraught with with errors, we're fraught with weaknesses, and we make mistakes all the time, and trying to ingrain in us a sense of understanding that there's room for tshuva. So the Torah communicates both those messages by having, on the one hand, in the Torah Shebichtav, a very idealistic picture of what things should be and what things shouldn't be. And at the same time, the Torah Shebaal Peh comes, the human input into Torah Shebichtav, and starts to moderate that. And when the Torah Shebichtav is actualized into human society, it starts becoming a little bit more compassionate, a little bit more moderated, a little bit more humanistic, if you will.
I think you could also look at it that the oral side is protecting the community from becoming the problem with power of killing somebody is it also taints the killer, the murderer, you know, the execution.
Right.
And so to some extent by not allowing man to actually, except in the king scenario, to actually fulfill this murder, proper murder, it's protecting that the executioner.
Yeah, I think that's a nice perspective also. Yeah, I hear that.
But that works in a society that's generally good and has some individuals who are making mistakes or doing things that they're not supposed to.
So again, that's where the Melech part comes in, with this source number four, the Drashot Haran, right? That we're going to have another track to fill in the gaps to make sure we're civil, because we don't want to be overly, you know, idealistic in this like nice humanistic human compassion sense. But I think that the messages that we're receiving from the Torah side, from the Torah of the Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaal Peh, from the Sanhedrin's track, is this dual message. Then at the same time, we have to make sure we have a built-in, you know, kind of security to make sure things function properly. So the Torah gives another track, which he's calling the Melech. But this dual message that's coming from the Sanhedrin part of things, I think, is really, really important. And so this idea that the Torah Shebichtav communicates to us a sense of idealism, a sense of kind of the more principled outlook on things, and the Torah Shebaal Peh comes in and adds a more humanistic element to it, a more understanding element to it. That's a really interesting paradigm, which I think you find in a number of places. I want to show you that. I think that's a really fascinating idea. So I'll show you a few more examples of that.
The thing that's really surprising to me is that basically the Torah, the strict Torah world, is idealistic. Because whether it's the Torah Shebichtav or the Torah Shebaal Peh, none of those appear to be sufficient to run a real society, which is kind of surprising. Like you would think that about the Torah Shebichtav, and that's why you have the Torah Shebaal Peh.
Right.
But then at the end of the day, to sort of look at it, I mean, the Ran's interpretation, and say, you know, the way that this has been interpreted is such that it is truly idealistic in a humanistic way. Who are humans to take other humans' life? That kind of thing leads you to
Your point that it's really actually they're both idealistic. The Torah Shebichtav is idealistic in a principled sense, and the Torah Shebaal Peh is idealistic in a humanistic sense.
But there's also
so that's what I'm getting to. Yeah,
in the Gemara, it's replete with examples of how the rabbis did this because they knew people would do this or this or that, and they'd say, you know, so. I don't know if it was so idealistic.
So I was going to suggest that possibly, even though it doesn't set up a perfect system, it sets up the standard for the perfect system and which to work on, and the principles, the basics for, you know, finding within ourselves the right thing to do and how to set up society, but not exactly handing it to us because God in his knowledge, you know, internal knowledge knows that times are going to change maybe and things are going to be different in each time. But the basic principles of how we treat each other and how we should behave, that these things that were punishable by death were so immoral, let's say, that we have to understand that, but we not necessarily, that's not really how we're going to punish them. But we have to understand that's the severity of it. And that helps us set the course for how we create our society.
Right. I mean, along those lines, I think that's well said. Like, what I was going to respond to you is that there's different levels of things, different layers. So, like, meaning on one level, this is one level of Torah Shebaal Peh in which we're kind of talking about two different idealisms, but neither is so pragmatic, right? But then there's also the level of Torah Shebaal Peh, which gives a tremendous amount of space for rabbinic creativity, right? and for, you know, for a Beitin to make a takana, right? And for development of other laws, or for the melech, the way the Ran puts it. The Rambam has a similar, the Rambam, instead of coming up with this idea that the Ran has about a melech, which is like a second track to the Beitin, the Rambam has a different way of putting it, which is that the Beitin themselves can do what's called a horat shah, right? That they can make a kind of limited decision in a certain moment, right? So that kind of fills in the gaps. I think the melech may also be able to do that, if I remember correctly. What did you say?
Martial law?
Maybe. I'm not. So the... Right, so the melech thing is a, I mentioned that before, the melech question is a little bit complicated. The Ran seems to almost make it, the Ran seems to be taking the approach that maybe the melech really was an ideal, so why were they punished for it? So there's, you know, there's a lot of different explanations for that. Maybe it's the way they asked, you know, different things. I don't want to get too caught up in that right now. But yeah, you want to say something?
I don't know if I can remember the question. Oh yeah, is it recorded anywhere how often this happens, either through Torah or through the melech?
How often what happens? So, well, that...
In general, it basically didn't, but...
Right.
Is there ever a reported instance where yes, it did, or the melech fills in gaps and yes, it did?
Right. I don't know. It's very possible that there is. I'm not familiar with it. Right. I mean, well, it could be, and I wouldn't do
this. First murder in history. Who's the melech Hamlachim? He didn't even sentence kind of to death. Maybe that's a big message to us. Right out of the box, when brother kills a brother, mm-hmm. and you think... this guy should be put to death. He just, and he didn't deny it.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah.
I don't know what to think about it. It was just,
that's
weird.
That's a really good example, because right away God said in the first brother's setup, I'm just going to send you away and protect you in another land.
Hmm.
Which is totally not what this is.
Right. It's interesting.
I know. It's weird.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay, a lot to think about. So I want to give you a few other examples where you see this phenomenon of Torah Bechtav having the more principled role and the Torah Shebaal Peh translating that, kind of moderating it, modifying it in a more humanistic sense. So in source number 5, we'll just do some of these outside, but the Gemara has, this is probably the most famous one, the Gemara has that in this past week's parsha, it says that if you damage somebody else, if you inflict a wound on someone else, so ayin tachat ayin, shein tachat shein, right, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, whatever it is, regal tachat regal, so you know, a foot for a foot. So the Torah Shebaal Peh comes and says, hold on a second, it doesn't mean literally an eye for an eye, it means that you pay them monetarily the amount, the value of an eye. It doesn't actually mean an eye for an eye. So right there, you see again this idea, and the Rambam talks about this, that the idea is that why does the Torah formulate it as an eye for an eye if it doesn't actually mean that? It's because in some idealistic way, you actually should be taking out an eye for an eye, because there is no monetary value to someone's eye. So how can you pay them an amount of money for a part of their body, for damaging their body? If you understand the value of a human, you can't think you can compensate them for that with paying them money. So really it should be an eye for an eye, so that you can go through a kind of a sense of understanding of what you just inflicted on somebody else. But we're not going to do that to people. So a more humanistic lens comes in with the Torah Shebaal Peh and kind of moderates that to saying you pay the money. So that's another example of this kind of concept. If you look in source 6, the Torah in this past week's parsha again says, "V'imshor nagachu mitmol shalshom v'huad biba'alav lo yishmerenu." So if you have a ox that gored and it was warned and it did it 3 times and the baal, the owner, still doesn't guard it properly, v'himit ish o isha, and this ox kills a person, hashor yisakel v'gam baalav yumat. The ox is killed, and who else is killed?
The owner.
Very explicit. V'gam ba'alav yumat. It's explicit. But says the Torah Shebaal Peh, it doesn't mean that the owner is literally killed, because you have to look at the next pasuk. Im kofer yushat alav, v'natan pidyon nafsho kechol asher yushat alav, that the owner is able to pay a certain amount of money to get themselves off the hook, to get an atonement. So it says the Torah Shebaal Peh, what we learn from these psukim is that it doesn't mean literally the owner is killed. It means the owner is killed bidei shamayim, meaning that they are considered morally responsible and God will take care of the justice. But we don't actually kill them, even though if you would look in the Torah Shebichtav, the simple reading of the Torah Shebichtav seems to be explicit that this owner should be killed. So again, you see this idea of a principled Torah Shebichtav with a more moderated Torah Shebaal Peh. The Rush, one of the Rishonim in Masechet Bava Kama, says this idea rather explicitly. He's talking not about Torah Shabbat Peh in general. He's talking about something called Halacha L'Moshe Mi-Sinai. Halacha L'Moshe Mi-Sinai is one of the aspects of Torah that was given to us at Har Sinai, that we have the Torah Shebichtav, then we have, so the Rambam has a whole bunch, there's a number of components to Torah Shabbat Peh. Without going into all of them, one of the components of Torah Shabbat Peh is that we're given certain traditions, certain things that Hashem told to Moshe, that this is how, that this is the halacha. And it's not written explicitly in the Torah Shebichtav. So those things are called halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai. Says the Rosh in source number 7, Mishum de Pshitalei, it's obvious to the Gemara, he's explaining something in the Sugya there, but he says it's obvious to the Gemara, De Hilchata Legruei Ata, that the Hilchata is another term in the Gemara for halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai. Okay, that's the simple explanation of Hilchataz, that means Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai. It comes Ligru'e, which means to be lenient. Ligru'e is the same thing as like Lahakel, to be lenient. Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai always comes to be lenient, says the Rosh. Kedamin and Gabe Sukkah, Atoy Hilchata Vigarata. That we say this by Sukkah. In a Sukkah, you would think if you have to make a Sukkah, what should you need? You should need a hut, a proper hut, standing with walls all around you. What does the Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai come and say? You can have a tremendous amount of airspace in your sukkah. It could be strings, right, with a couple of, you know, hand breadths in between each string, and you can use all these different halachot called lavud and good asik and good achis and all these different things to make it that you have this kind of fictionary halachic sukkah, which has these halachic walls that don't exist as actual physical material. You could have two walls and a piece of a third, right? All these different halachot to be very lenient in halachot sukkah. Again, this is this idea that the Rosh says that halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai always comes to be more lenient in what we say. In source number 8, we'll do one last example of this. The Gemara in Makot says, Amar Rava. Rava said, Kama tipshai shar inshi. How foolish, how silly are people, the kaimi mikame sefer Torah, that they stand up in front of a sefer Torah, the lo kaimi mikame gava rabba, and they don't stand up in front of a great Torah scholar. Why is that foolish? They don't do that. The ilu b'sefer Torah k'tiv arbaim, because in the sefer Torah, in the Torah itself, it says, how many lashes should you get, maximum? 40 lashes. In the Torah itself, it says 40. But how many do the rabbis say you can get? Atu rabbanan batzru chada. The rabbis came and said you can only have 39. You can't get 40. So again, you have this idea that the Torah Shabbat Peh, the rabbanan come and they moderate the principle, the idealistic sense of the Torah Shebichtav. And I think this is a really interesting idea, a really fascinating idea. And I think it's so profound in the depths of the Torah. And to me, it speaks this idea that I mentioned before, that the Torah is communicating to us a dual message. On the one hand, having a principled, strict, and real sense of how much what we do matters, and that is being communicated to us in the Torah Shabbat Peh, representing the ideals, what our standards theoretically should be. It's teaching us our standards. And then at the same time, the Torah Shabbat Peh comes and teaches how to actualize those with an understanding and a sense of human nature.
Maybe I'm misunderstanding it, but why does it feel to me like Shabbos, Pesach, Kashrut is so much simpler in the Torah, and then the rabbis expanded
right.
So it's not the punishments,
right,
but the yoke of
how
Judaism.
Much there is to be dealing with, right? So I thought about that. What do you? I don't know. What does anyone think? Any thoughts? I was thinking about that question.
This man.
What do you say?
It was men.
But this is a man complaining still.
No. Well, you have to know his house. Yeah. Stand for total yucca. But I do feel that a lot of this is a very male-oriented thing, that they weren't as involved in what it takes to get to that point, and therefore, I think...
But even separate from Pesach, we could talk about Shabbos.
The lulav is detailed.
I mean, yeah, I mean,
it's not just the
I mean, just to push back on that a little bit, the plenty of the things that like you would be referring to are things that were very imposing on men's lifestyles also.
Yeah.
Right? So I don't know if that, you know...
No, I'm just a little bit of a joke. But it is weird.
Any thoughts?
I think it's more medactic today than it was. I spent last Pesach in Israel. And quite honestly, I was just like amazed at how relaxed Israelis are about Israel. They're not so uptight, you know, okay, this they don't have an extra refrigerator, so they just cover that shelf with tinfoil, and those are, you know, mm-hmm. and they're very machmir on that it's a, you know, it's not about seeing it, it's about eating it, and they're very, like, it's just, I think we're very uptight here. I think we get very crazed in the diaspora about every little detail and every little thing, and we need to, like, just dial it back, and mm-hmm. we need a lot less chumras and a lot more mm-hmm. knowledge.
You go, girl. You're right.
So I think, I mean, the other thing, there's a large degree of truth to that. That's what we spoke about either last week or 2 weeks ago, right, with from the Baal Shem Tov about, mm-hmm. Right? So we spoke about that. I definitely think there's a large degree of truth to that. I don't know if that accounts for everything, in my opinion, though.
I'm sure not.
But the Torah wasn't going to be able to detail, you know, all the situations and all the things. And that's what the scholarship over the past, you know, thousands of years, I mean, you know, since the Torah was given,
mm-hmm.
it was, you know, the Torah Shabbat, it's all, I guess, Torah Shabbat.
Right. Right.
So, but if you want,
I mean, sorry, go ahead.
No, finish what you're saying.
I was just saying, meaning, if you look at it not so much as a question of, so I've been kind of blurring two different types of ideas. One is, you know, principles versus kind of, you know, humanism, you know, so kind of ideals versus the practical side of things as the Torah Shabbat Tav versus Torah Shabbat Peh. And another thing that I've been until now conflating with that, but I'm now wondering if we should kind of, you know, pull them apart for a second, is machmir versus makil, is like strict versus lenient. And I've been kind of lumping those two different things together, like the principles with the machmir and the lenient with the practical. But, you know, it could be that to a degree, the point might not be about strict versus lenient. It might be about, again, this principles versus the practical and the actualized version of it. Because the Torah Shabbat Peh, in adding all the things it adds, what it's trying to do, and this is part of what I think you were just saying, what it's trying to do is figure out a way to make those principles come alive in an actualized world, right? And in their eyes, and, you know, and there's room to complain about this, and I can understand that, but there's room to wonder about, you know, was, you know, why did they have to go this far, etc. Those are valid questions, but you have to understand, from their eyes, what the Rabbanon were doing in the Gemara with a lot of their takanot and a lot of the things that they seem to be imposing extra burdens, what they're trying to do is set up a more almost secure way that will ensure that people follow the things properly, right? So it actually is another example of them trying to humanize the Torah. What they're doing is understanding human nature, right? So let's say, for example, let's say like a halacha of yichud, right? So in the Torah, a halacha of yichud, about, you know, a man being with a married woman is strictly limited in the Torah to a man and a married Jewish woman being together, okay? That's the only case of yichud in the Torah. The Rabbanan added lots of cases to that, to be now also part of the Isser of yichud. What they were doing in that was being very sensitive to human nature and realizing, in today's world, we could very readily understand that there was a lot of wisdom to what they were trying to do, right, with how fraught we are with, you know, all this stuff, right? That was them being pragmatic, right, being sensitive to human nature and trying to intuit and foresee what needs to be imposed to actually live up to the Torah's principles. Or even when it comes to Pesach, so let's use the Chametz Pesach example. Now, we might feel like this is, it kind of counter, it went the wrong way, but the intention of setting up all the extra stringencies around Chametz was because they thought that seeing human nature, in order for us to actually keep the Torah's laws of Chametz, we have to set up extra boundaries to make sure that we're not going to be violating the Torah's principled laws. So what the Torah Shabbat Peh is doing, at least in its attempt, is trying to set up, it is trying to take a more humanized, right, not in the lenient sense, but in a understanding human nature sense, to create what's necessary for the actualization of Torah.
Okay. Totally buy that.
Okay.
Totally buy it. But,
wow, that was, I'm shocked, yeah.
No. No. I totally buy it, except.
Yeah. Hold on.
No. You're right. But that I have to actually say, I think I lost my train of thought.
I'm sorry.
No, not you. It's just very tired. I buy that they created this to protect us, you know,
mm-hmm.
into doing the halacha right. Okay, move on, because I totally
let me
forgot.
Okay, jump in when you remember. Yeah. Jump in. Yeah.
We don't often do this, but when you apply the layer or the filter of history to this question, I think it also may make it more complicated and interesting,
mm-hmm.
because what emerged, in other words, whether the Torah Shebaal Peh evolved and how it evolved, and what emerged from a particular time of history where it grew and developed, and the culture of it, the culture of the Gemara, and et cetera, ends up creating much of what Rich is describing, right? One generation builds on
mm-hmm.
the next, and it's as if you're building, you know,
right.
a house on that. If you go back in history, there were a lot of conflicts about what was the right interpretation, what was not,
right.
Whether the Beit HaMikdash was built on the same Torah Shebaal Peh system that we live in today, and all of that. So it is kind of interesting that perhaps that's what has emerged as the mainstream tradition,
mm-hmm.
but it wasn't necessarily, you know, there from the beginning,
mm-hmm.
in the
right.
same way, you know,
that's
to Rich's point.
That's
yeah.
good, because that's sort of where I was going is, I realize what now what I was going to say is, I buy into what you're saying, except that it doesn't feel that way.
Yes, yeah.
That's what I wanted to say.
Right.
And that's sort of like, it feels like it's a burden.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't feel like it's a protection.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
And that's a lot more complicated to say, well, in other words, the Torah may have been presented this way and it evolved
mm-hmm.
in that direction, because we tend to look at them as both equal. So they're
mm-hmm.
both there at the beginning. Why would you have this and that when they seem to contradict each other?
Mm-hmm.
But they may not be exactly parallel. They may,
mm-hmm.
you know, it may have evolved in the humanistic direction.
Right.
Whereas it may not have emphasized that quite as much or in the amount of detail in the beginning.
Right.
Just
yeah.
to get to Sandy's point, it is also interesting that things that do seem burdensome for whatever reason at times, it also, to your point, somehow enables us to get inside the experience so that when we get all done with whatever it is that got us to that point, we are totally absorbed in typically the experience, the thought process, hopefully the spirituality that separates that particular moment in time.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's a chag or a mitzvah that we're supposed to be doing, from so that there's distinction.
Right, right. It forces us to be fully immersed.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. yeah. Do you want
I have
something?
Two questions, but they're
yeah.
not on this. It's like backing up to earlier.
go ahead.
Okay. One is at the top when you were going through, like, look, you really essentially don't have the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
Was that? Did it also fall out that way for the lashes situation?
I think to a large degree, but not to the, I don't think that the person needing to say that I'm accepting the death upon myself, you know, the punishment of death upon myself, and I'm doing it anyways. I don't think that clause, that stipulation applies to lashes. I think only the general need for warning applies to lashes. I think
we can help with another whole thing for the lash people. That maybe isn't on the page.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
the other,
oh, I'm sorry, go on.
The other question was, I had been taught that there was a mistranslation in Eye for an Eye. It was like back to King James, and then everyone took it from there, that the word for was not actually in the Hebrew. I was taught that it was in the place of, an eye in the place of,
uh-huh.
or an eye replaces an eye. But one can't do that, so one gives them the money. Meaning it wasn't a softening on the oral side, it was to begin
mm-hmm.
with already, it meant something other than how it was translated.
Okay, so I mean, I hadn't heard it formulated exactly that way, but definitely the Rishonim say that the Torah Shebaal Peh is actually coming and explaining that it's. So there's two different types of Torah Shebaal Peh explaining the Torah Shebichtav. Sometimes it's explaining that it says one thing, but it actually means, we have a tradition, it means something else. Sometimes what the Torah Shebaal Peh is doing is coming and saying, this is actually what it means in the Torah. When the Torah says an eye in place of an eye, it actually means an eye, the value of an eye in place of an eye. It doesn't mean an eye for an eye. But even if that's the case, the point is that you still see that the Torah Shebichtav on a interpretive, on a just a translation level,
yeah,
seems to mean that you're giving up an eye in place of another eye. The Torah Shebaal Peh is the one that informs us that it doesn't actually mean that.
Okay.
Right? So I think you still have this kind of phenomenon. Let's take one last point so we can just finish up the ideas. You want to say something?
I just want to make a comment because I came in late, and the discussion tonight is, part of it is, I guess, punishment for, and why is it not happening when it's supposed to happen? But we always learn classically that none of us would be around if Hashem had the strict judgment from
right.
the Torah. But what overwhelms me, and I'm sure everybody here, is every Yom Kippur when you learn that story and how unfair these rabbis who are just incredible, all they wanted to do was serve Hashem.
Mm-hmm.
And they were massacred because
right.
of the brothers killing. So that punishment, I think we're learning, it comes. We just don't know when it's hit. And how we affect, which is scary, future generations, every single thing we do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, maybe we're alive, but
right.
later generations and
yeah.
the afterworld. I mean, I know we're getting pretty deep here. yeah, I know.
So it's
yeah.
I'm not going to sleep tonight. Thanks.
So now none of us can?
Yeah, yeah,
thanks
yeah,
a lot.
Well,
so
I'm not going to.
Yeah. At least there'll be a
party at George's house.
You know, you can call up in
yes.
the morning.
So let's try and bring this all together a little bit. I mean, these are all important thoughts and questions, and I certainly don't have answers to most of them. But I think it's good conversation. Just to bring these points home. So in source number 9, the Yismach Moshe Sefer Chassidus quotes from the Arizal exactly this idea. V'hinei ha'inyin dehilchos avadei lekula kula asi, that this idea of the Torah Shebaal Peh coming to be. So again, now we have to go back to what I was distinguishing between before, between principles versus, you know, the pragmatic actualization in the human sense versus the idea of strict versus lenient. So here he's formulating it as lenient. Maybe that's the idea. Alternatively, maybe that's their way of formulating the idea of being pragmatic about it. I'm not sure so what to think about. But he says, that the idea of the Torah Shebaal Peh coming to be more lenient to, the idea is, this is explained in what we find in the writings of the Arizal. The Torah Shebichtav hu din. This is exactly what Dov said before. The Torah Shebichtav, the written Torah, is din. V'shebaal Peh hu rachamim. And the Torah Shebaal Peh is the channel of rachamim, of mercy. And therefore, kfi hakatov have a chumra, the Torah will formulate things in a more strict way. V'hu kfi shurat hadin hagamor, in the principled fashion. Aval Torah Shebaal Peh mitzad rachamim, but the Torah Shebaal Peh will be formulated in a more compassionate sense. The last example of this that I wanted to bring out, and I think it's just an incredibly beautiful piece, so we'll try and run through this just in a couple last minutes before Maariv, is a piece from the Munat Itecha, is written by someone named Moshe Wolfson, who's a contemporary, lives in Brooklyn, and he wrote a sefer called Emunas Itecha, and he has a beautiful piece about the topic of Ben Sorer Umore. So the last example that I offer you of this idea, this phenomenon of Torah Shebichtav being the principled and the Torah Shebaal Peh being the humanistic, is Ben Sorer Umore. Ben Sorer Umore is the wayward child, the rebellious child, and the rebellious child is put to death for different actions they do, based on the assumption, the Gemara says, that we know the end that's going to come for this child. We see where these things are headed, and we want to let them die while they're still innocent and not guilty. Okay, how does that fit with the notion of, you know, judging someone in the moment if they're not? Lots of different questions about that. Let's not get into it too much. Too many questions to even outline, but that's the idea in the Gemara. But the Gemara says, according to one opinion that's generally accepted, that Ben Sora Umora Lohaya Velo Asilios. Ben Sorumor never was and never will be. So that's the most extreme example of any of the ones we've seen before, because previously we've seen moderating how often it happens, or kind of, you know, moderating how it happens. But this example is Ben Sorumor is a clear few psukim in the Torah, and the Gemara says, not only are we moderating it, we're saying that it literally never happened, and we're saying it never will happen. So then what's the point in the Torah teaching it to us? So says the Gemara, why is the Torah teaching us if it never happened, it never will happen? It's teaching it to us for the, it says, drosh v'kabel schar, you should learn about it and receive reward for learning about it. So what does that mean? There's lots of different interpretations of that. Moshe Wolfson has a beautiful interpretation. I'm going to like speed read through this just to wrap it up in like 90 seconds. He says the following. The idea of is the following. Chazal say, Sheben Sora Umora Neharag Al Shem Sofa. The rebellious child is killed for their eventual end. Sheamr Torah Mutav Yamos Zakai Va Yamos Chayv. It's better to die innocent than guilty. V'hinei kol neshama miYisrael huchelak el kamim al. We have to understand every single Jewish person is a divine soul. V'ein mitzios lifsok al adam miYisrael shekvar afsa kol tikva v'ein odef shara sheyachsel mutav. He says it's impossible to say, to ever stamp a Jewish person and say this person has no hope of return, that there's no tshuva possible for this person, that this divine soul is at its dead end. There's no, that we know for sure they're gonna fall into the abyss. Ukemosh Rom anu biyamenu ela. We see in our days sheelu kvar nishko benun sharitim. We see so many people have fallen, sunken so low, chazrim b'tshuva, but they come back. Umisromim bechela rab, and they rise up to high lofty places. Mimakom shnishku, even from the lowest depths. The imkan, and therefore lo shayach laharog ben sora umara al svara shiyam bozak v'lemischayv. It's impossible to ever employ the idea that we're going to kill this person now so that they die innocent rather than be guilty in the future. Because we can never say about a person that we know they're going to be guilty in the future. We can never stamp a person and say that we know for sure they can't change. So therefore, the idea of what Ben Sora Moshe is coming to teach us is it's coming to teach us specifically that never will happen. It's not that the Torah is teaching it to us even though it won't happen. What the Torah is coming to teach us is that it will never happen. We will never stamp someone a Ben Sora Moshe. We will never say about a person that this person has no possible move towards tshuva. And that's specifically what the Ben Sora Moshe is coming to teach us. And that's exactly, I think, this idea, this dual message that the Torah contains through the Torah Shebech Tav and the Torah Shebech Peh, of this sense of standards that we should have for ourselves and for our society. We should have standards, high standards, understanding the significance and the severity of our choices and our actions. And at the same time, another message of humanism and compassion, understanding that there's always room for tshuva, and that we should have understand that people make mistakes and people make errors, and we can hopefully rectify them and hopefully make a turn for a better path. Thank you, everyone. Yeah.